Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here with a few notable stories from our daily news site. Well, first, Dave, the link between the mobility of leeches and human happiness. This one ought to be good.
Well, Stuart, this story is about how leeches can eat so much. In fact, some leeches can gorge on so much blood that they can swell up to 10 times their normal size, as disgusting as that sounds, and still wriggle away. And as you say, the trick has to do with a human hormone known as serotonin. The mystery here is, if you sort of think about a balloon, if a balloon is not fully blown up, you can sort of play with it, you can expand it, you can contract it. That's very much like the muscles in our body. The way we move around is our muscles expand and contract. But if you were to fill that balloon almost up to busting, it's not very malleable at all. And our muscles are the same way. When they're stretched to their limit, they can't expand and contract. So it's been a mystery of how leeches can become so swollen, and yet they're still able to do the expanding and contracting they need to do to wriggle around.
And so to solve this mystery, someone had to play around a lot with some swollen leeches, it sounds like.
They did. It probably wasn't the most pleasant experiment. And actually, one of the authors has said that she actually has trouble getting people to come into her lab because she's working with leeches all day. But basically, yes, she and a colleague filled a tank with sheep blood, added some leeches, sort of let them go crazy and drink as much blood as they wanted. And then they chopped the leeches up. So not a good ending for the leeches. But they chopped the leeches up and they stimulated these pieces of leeches with electrical current to figure out how their muscles expand and contract. And what they also did was they added some serotonin, which has already been shown to be important in leech feeding. It wasn't really known what its function was in how the leeches use their muscles. And then what they found was that without the serotonin, the leeches or the leech pieces had a very hard time expanding and contracting, just like a very extended muscle would. But when they added the serotonin, they had a much easier time getting the leech muscles to expand and contract. So they hypothesized that somehow serotonin relaxes the leech muscles and allows them to expand and contract, even though they are really almost stretched beyond their limits.
And it sounds from the story like they almost turned them into super muscles in a way, I mean, in terms of their contraction.
They were. And in fact, the muscles were able to stretch up to 300%. In humans, we only get a muscle change of about 20%.
So good news for the leeches. The next story, I guess, an interesting kind of gastronomic take on the history of dog domestication.
Well, right, sir. This story is about the first evidence of dogs in the New World. And while that sounds like good news, it actually has sort of an unfortunate twist because these early dogs appear to have been dinner. This story is about a human coprolite, and the coprolite is basically a fossilized feces that was found in a cave in Texas. And this coprolite's about 9,000 years old. Specifically, it's 9,260 years old, according to radiocarbon dating. And when scientists were looking in this coprolite, they detected some prickly pear seeds, which was a common component of the human diet way back then. They also found some small bones belonging to fish, birds, and rodents. But they found one bone that they found highly unusual. It belonged to a relatively large mammal. They couldn't figure out what it was, and so they did some analysis, and it turns out this bone belongs to the occipital condyle, which is a knob-like structure that's found on the back of the head of dogs. And so they said, well, this seems to be evidence that humans were not only living with dogs at this very early time, but also eating them as well. They did some more genetic analysis with this, and the genetic analysis revealed that this wasn't a wolf or something else, some other member of the dog family. The DNA suggested that this was a dog that belonged to modern and ancient dogs. But anyway, you cut it, this was a dog that would have been probably not easily mistaken for one of our companions today. They figure this dog was about 25 to 30 pounds and possessed a short nose and is similar to what scientists believe the type of dogs that Native Americans hung out with around this time. But this dog probably did not meet a happy end because if he was a companion, he also ended up on somebody's dinner plate as well.
Well, I guess, I mean, we're a bit put off by it now, but it doesn't seem that surprising to me that ancient humans might have regarded dogs as food any more than any other animals.
Exactly. And actually, there's actually very recent evidence. In 1912, the Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen actually ate his sled dogs on a trip to the South Pole and said they were actually quite tasty, or at least it wasn't a real hardship to eat these dogs. And there's also
not a hardship for him.
Not a hardship for him, maybe for the dogs. There are tales of Aboriginal hunters in Greenland eating their sled dogs in the winter. And actually, there are some cultures in the world today that still eat dogs. So while this story may not sit well with a lot of Americans, this probably wasn't a very unusual practice, as you allude to, Stuart.
And finally, a bit of misbehavior by planets outside of the solar system. Tell us about that.
Well, Stuart, although the planets in our solar system are widely varied, they all have one thing in common. They all orbit our sun in the same way. But that is not the case for a lot of other solar systems out there. In 2009, scientists found what's called a hot Jupiter. And basically, this is a very large planet about the size of Jupiter, but that orbits so close to its sun that it's very hot, hence the name hot Jupiter. But what was unusual about this planet was that it was orbiting in the opposite direction to the spin of its sun.
Well, I guess that's not like our solar system.
Definitely not like our solar system. And for a few years now, scientists have been trying to figure out how that happens. And the theory was that as a solar system forms, there's a disk of gas and dust that whirls around the star in one direction. Planets form out of this disk. But sometimes these planets, when they're forming, can sort of interact with each other, sort of jostle each other around, sort of like a pretty violent game of pool. And when this happens, it's possible that some planets will start orbiting in the wrong direction. But in this new study, researchers come up with another idea. They ran some computer simulations of hot Jupiters and other planets that might be orbiting in the wrong direction, or at least what we call the wrong direction, because it's different from how our solar system works, around its star. And what they found was that if there was a planet or a brown dwarf that was some distance away from the star and a planet that was orbiting it, that over time, this object could exert enough gravitational influence on the planet that would actually start tilting it and tilting it and tilting it even more and more until at some point its orbit actually flipped in the opposite direction, and then it started orbiting its star in a different direction than the star was spinning.
That seems a little bit like spooky action at a distance. I mean, it's a kind of a weak interaction for such a massive effect.
It is. But according to the computer simulations, it does work. It does take a long time for this to happen. And it's not the final word. I mean, obviously, this is just a computer simulation. As one outside expert notes, it's an interesting idea, but really prove that this is actually happening, scientists are actually going to have to find these brown dwarfs or other objects that are actually exerting this effect on the planets to see if this is actually what is causing the planets to flip their orbits in the first place.
Well, Dave, what other stories are you looking into for the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story on quantum computers, a new progress in actually creating these types of computers. Also a story about how seals sense fish by using their whiskers, especially in very murky water. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about Germany shutting down a controversial stem cell clinic. There's a lot of these clinics popping up around the world that promise miraculous stem cell therapies, and Germany, for one, is starting to really crack down on these. Also a story about the devastating tornadoes that recently hit the U.S. and how scientists are utilizing pictures that were taken on the ground to figure out exactly how these tornadoes wreaked their havoc. And finally, on Science Live, our new weekly chat with scientists on the hottest topics in science, we've got a chat with prominent scientists about new avenues towards curing AIDS. This relates to the news focus that you talked about earlier in the podcast, Stuart. And it'll be a great chance for readers to ask their questions about what is going on in the field of AIDS research. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.